you therefore, as a smart guy, can put the right amount of inductance across the tuning, across the terminals of the antenna, or the feed line in the shack. You can put the right inductor and the impedance matching device. You can force it to work at your particular frequency, and therefore you can go one step beyond. Each of these guys doing a foxhole transmitter had a very simple long wire and a ground, and with that coil in series with it, they hoped they hit resonance or something close to it, but you could force your dipole to do it. It's a little bit more difficult than impedance match, but it is a deterministic problem. By way of that Brown and Woodward curve, you know essentially with very small variance what impedance your antenna is going to be. You can correct for it, and therefore you can make the radio work at that frequency. And by the way, I strongly recommend you use a real Schottky diode. You're going to get a lot more performance than you would out of a razor braid. The razor braid is what you had to do in 1948 because you didn't have a Schottky diode that you go to Radio Shack and buy. Over to you, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW, in the TechNet.
Yeah, I know. Our goal is always to improve the reception and all the variables. And so that's interesting, and I could use the curves to properly match the antenna, but I'm really not looking to do that. I'm trying to keep it as simple as possible. And what I was really asking, and then I'll give you the bigger reason for it in a minute, but what I'm really asking is, obviously, there's no impedance matching when someone takes a random piece of wire and uses it as the antenna and then attaches the other end to a water pipe. So I'm wondering, you know, why would that, do you think that that system, using it to a water pipe and a variable length of antenna wire, or a random piece of antenna wire, would that work better than using a dipole, even if you're not properly tuned?
When you put a so-called random length of wire with a coil of wire wrapped around a oatmeal cardboard tube, and then you connect that to the antenna terminal. That actually goes to, I guess, the crystal diode, maybe with an RF choker with a bypass resistor. And then the grounding of the system is the water pipe. You're really building a quarter wave, a quasi-quarter wave monopole antenna. You're building a ground plane antenna. In order for the antenna to work well, and whether you're transmitting or receiving doesn't matter, it's the exact same function because of the law of reciprocity. You need a counterpoise. The grounding wire and using the whole earth as the counterpoise drastically improves the impedance match to the antenna. Makes it work better. By way of the coil of wire on the oatmeal cardboard and that random length of wire, it's an extremely low Q antenna, reasonably broadband, and it's quite forgiving. The good news is it's fairly forgiving in bandwidth and frequency of resonance. The bad news is that if you have two AM radio stations nearby, one at 770 on the dial and one at 1010 on the dial, so to speak, you're going to not be able to separate them, most likely, without doing some other heroic work. Whichever one is stronger in your neighborhood is the one that's going to dominate. And in some cases, you're going to hear both of them on top of each other, if you know what I mean. But you're really building a broadband monopole antenna, and for the amount of wire, the quarter wave is going to give you more bang for the dollar than the dipole. The dipole, though, once you do the impedance matching with the dipole, now for the first time you're going to really have frequency selective capability because it's a higher Q structure. It pays your money, it takes your choice. Each has an advantage. And you have the possibility of making that choice if you want to, Alan. Back to you, K2RIW.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now I see why they haven't recommended using dipoles for these either the foxhole radios or the crystal radios. And the bigger reason for all this is the conversation we were having one morning, Dick, is we were talking about if you ever watch these survival shows or these shows, you know, I shouldn't be alive, you know, somebody may be stranded somewhere because, you know, their plane, you know, crash landed or whatnot, shipwrecked. And, you know, it would be nice to be able to plug into the world and see if someone's looking for you. That was actually the case in that Uruguayan plane that went down that became the movie for Alive, where they actually had to eat some of the passengers. But I was, you know, it made me think. It's nice to be able to receive. But, you know, Dick, you're a radio engineer. You're the real deal. If you had, you know, obviously the transmitters are scrapped from the crash or whatnot. what do you think you could do to make a transmitter that might transmit 3 or 5 miles, just give you a larger, you know, a large radio footprint that if anybody were looking for you might be able to tune in on? What would you do?
Each of these people who got themselves in trouble with hindsight could have done a better job. If they had more winter clothing, if they had more food, if they had an ELT transmitter on board. If you know you're going to fly over the Andes, and you know there's the possibility that the engine could give you a flame out, or because of bad weather you're going to possibly crash into a mountain, with hindsight, you could make sure that you've got radios on board prepared to communicate once you're down. Here I am, come get me. You take, for instance, that guy, I can't remember his name right now, who went off in the wilderness and was doing mountain climbing all by himself, and as he was climbing up or down a rock wall, his arm was in the wall, the rock moved in such a way that his arm was jammed, and there he was for the next couple of days, and until he took out his Swiss Army knife and cut off his arm at the elbow. And can you imagine, had he dropped that Swiss Army knife at the wrong time, had he passed out, had he not set the right kind of a tourniquet ahead of time so he didn't bleed to death, the fact that the guy survived is one hell of a story. However, with hindsight, boy, did he need a friend who knew where he was, that could go search for him if he didn't come back in time. He needed radios with him. He needed all kinds of protection equipment. So the right answer is bring the right equipment ahead of time when you know, when you know you're going into a dangerous area. Now, you and I have watched many of these programs where Spock will take a laser gun and convert it into a radio transmitter. I mean, it's nice to see these situations. Could you really do it? Could you take a tube-type receiver and convert it into a transmitter and get it on the right frequency and get enough power output into an antenna where people would hear you? It's possible, but my goodness, is it difficult. But with modern-day, solid-state, surface-mounted equipment, could you convert a receiver into a transmitter and put out enough power that they're going to find you? I think that's a long shot. You're way ahead of the game to spend some extra money. Bring the right safety equipment with you before you go. If you know you're going into a dangerous area, prepare for it. If not, you're putting your life at risk, and it's kind of foolish in my opinion. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Authentic?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
If the gel packs survive on there, you could build a spark transmitter. Very simple, and they will hear you. How about that? Back to you, Dick.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, the good news about a spark transmitter is it does transmit from DC to light. The bad news is the signal it makes is awfully weak compared to a sine wave transmitter. If they're a mile away from you, yes. If they're 50 miles away from you, unless you put up a monstrous antenna, I don't think they're going to hear your spark gap transmitter. I hope I'm wrong, but that's what I'm worried about. Over to you, Alan.
Fix the old radio.
Yeah, well, I know you do watch like a Star Trek, the old Star Trek, where Spock converts a few radio parts into a computer. I wouldn't think we'd go that far, but definitely setting up a SparkCap transmitter of some sort. You know, even if it gives you 5 miles of transmission, and how would you roughly? And maybe you've already thought of this, John. How would you roughly hook that up from parts? And how do you connect that to an antenna to give you a chance of radiating that broadband spurious radiation out?
And you need a few kilovolts to make a healthy spark. How would you generate that spark, John? Over to you, John.
Well, Dick, I've done it with a 6-volt car battery, and it worked well. The arc is so intense. I grounded one end of the battery, and I just put a wire on the other end, and I would put my arcing device, which was just two simple wires, across those terminals, and every time I struck it, the wires would flash tremendously. But that signal was enormous. And usually, you've got air sea rescue above, you've got aerial assets, and that transmitter in the air will go pretty far. Yeah, in the mountainous area, from mountain to mountain, you may have a problem. But to aircraft, I don't think there would be a problem with it. It was just direct short across the battery, flashing the wires.
That's going to give you a very strong signal to a radio nearby. But to get that into a strong signal at frequencies where they are listening, in the old days, the emergency frequencies used to be, I think it was 121.5 and 243 megacycles, I think were the emergency frequencies that used to be listened to. And the ELTs these days, I think, are on 406 megacycles.
They were on 500 kilohertz also.
Is 500 kilohertz still being monitored by rescue aircraft these days?
The interference would be tremendous, I would believe. They would hear you.
Yeah, but do we still have... I mean, the old galloping Gertie that put out a 500 kilohertz signal is essentially gone. So do rescue aircraft have a 500 kilohertz receiver these days? I'm a little worried about that one. Over to you, John.
I know they'd be able to receive it if they tuned it. Are they tuned in monitoring? No, I don't think so.
I'm beginning to think the best answer, Alan, is a ELT transmitter.
The old radio.
These old electronic, what do they call it, ELT? I can't remember what it stands for now, but emergency type of radios. They're being monitored by satellites continuously, and they pin you down to a very small area. So to carry the right equipment when you're going into a dangerous area, I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's time now we go to Mel's Corner. And, John, what kind of questions have we had this week? KC2 WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGV. Two simple ones for you, Dick. One is right up your alley. There's a young man, Joe, in Brooklyn, who is going to receive a dual-band radio, a 2-meter, 70-centimeter radio for Christmas. So I guess he got tipped. And he wants to know, he has two separate antennas, and he would like to know if he could use a simple T connector up on the mast to put those two antennas together and bring down one run of RG58. And would that work for him, or should he bring down two to a separate switch? That's his dilemma. Maybe you could give him some words on that.
I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. A 2-meter antenna being fed on 432 probably is going to present a fairly high standing wave ratio, a whole lot of reactants. Correspondingly, the 70-meter antenna, if it's a rubber duck-like antenna, fed on 2 meters, is almost an open circuit. So the two antennas going into a T-connector are a kind of automatic switch. The right frequency will go into the right antenna with one slight check. Make sure that the 70-centimeter antenna is the kind that when you put an ohm meter from center conductor to ground, it's not a short circuit. There are some kinds of 70-centimeter antennas that are a short circuit DC-wise with an ohm meter, and they become a real antenna only at the 70 centimeters. So as long as yours is a rubber duck-like thing or other kinds of antennas that are an open circuit on the unused frequency, then a T-connector will definitely work. It'll be slightly lower in performance than the cable going straight to the appropriate antenna when you're on the appropriate frequency. And someday, if you want to, you can either build or buy a real duplexing filter. Let me drop. The total number of parts that go into a duplexing filter is probably two coils and two capacitors, and you build it into a tuna fish can if you want to. People have done that very successfully. You build a duplexing filter. A duplexing filter is where you've got one input connector going to the transmission line that goes down into the house, and you have two output connectors. And the way the filter works is that it automatically feeds the 70-centimeter signal out to the 70-centimeter connector and the 2-meter signal out the 2-meter connector. That'll give you a little bit higher performance. Not very expensive. To buy it is a little bit pricey. To build it, once you find the right design, and with a little bit of searching on the internet, and I guarantee there's been a couple of articles in QST Magazine on how to homebrew a 2-meter 440 duplexing filter. I said duplexing, I mean diplexing. Diplexing is where it selects which antenna the right frequency goes to. Duplexing is where you're transmitting and receiving simultaneously on two slightly different frequencies. So it's a diplexing filter. We got to use the right words here, or you won't give a good successful search for it. So I'll bet you've seen some of these articles on diplexing filters. They're not very elaborate. Pretty easy to build, in my opinion. It's a little bit beyond a beginner project, but because the total number of parts required is so small, the total cost is so small, if at first it doesn't work, it's not a disaster. If at worst you have to bring it over to Andy's house, to the A2CDL, for him to do the little tip-top tuning for you, there's a beautiful solution there. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. His next question, same fellow, is the distance he should separate them on the mast, and that'll complete his questions.
The answer is probably 6 inches. You'd be amazed how close they can be together. The 2-meter antenna is almost an open circuit in air as far as the 70-centimeter antenna is concerned, and vice versa. When you're putting two antennas together that are on the exact same frequency, there's a definite minimum stacking distance you should use, because each antenna, even though your eye doesn't see it, has a certain effective capture area. Usually it's kind of an ellipse in space. It's a three-dimensional ellipse of rotation. It's an egg-shaped object in space, if you know what I mean. And you'd like to separate the two antennas when they're on the same frequency so that the two egg-shaped objects in space don't overlap each other. Then you get full performance. But the egg-shaped object collapses when you're on the wrong band. In other words, if I'm looking at the 2-meter antenna and I've got radio eyes and I see this watermelon-shaped object in space, which is its effective capture area on 2 meters, and then I dial a signal that I'm sending into it up to 70 centimeters instead of 2 meters, that watermelon-shaped object in three-dimensional space, its effective capture area, squeezes down to a lemon, if you know what I mean, instead of a watermelon. And so its effective area on the wrong frequency goes to zero. Therefore, on two antennas on the same mast that are on different frequencies, you'll be amazed how close you can put them. The answer really is far enough away so that the capacitive loading effect of the tips of the elements of one antenna doesn't add too much capacitance because of the presence of the other antenna. And if you're willing to retune those elements because of that close loading capacitance, you can actually put them on the exact same structure. Let me drop.
Quebec Gulf City.
Bill recognized. You can, in the old days, the Fenco 6 and 2 was a 6-meter antenna and 2-meter antenna built on the exact same boom. This was a Yagi structure that had some 6-meter elements and some 2-meter elements interstitially diffused, you know, with the, in between each other, and where the little bit of capacitance from one antenna to the other was tuned out, so to speak. So there's a stacking distance of zero, and it was an extremely successful antenna. So if the frequencies are different, you'd be amazed how close you can stack them. But these guys in Massapequa, they've been down this road a long time ago, and they've got it all learned out. All right. WB2QGZ, hey, Bill, how would you solve this one? K2RIW, you got it, Bill.
Hey, good evening. WBQQGZ, just a quick suggestion. You could probably find with a web search for a dual band J-pole a number of different construction techniques, some made out of twin lead, some made out of pieces of tubing and stuff. I don't have any specific articles to reference, but honestly, between QST and trolling around online, I've probably seen the construction plans for a couple different types of dual band J-poles in the last year or so, so they shouldn't be too difficult to find. That would let you just run one transmission line up top, secure it to the antenna, it would work on both bands, and you wouldn't have to worry about the spacing or building a diplex or anything else. That might be a quick way to wrangle that issue. WA2QGZ.
Another good suggestion, Bill. I thank you. And many of these homebrew articles on a so-called J-pole antenna, they contain $2 worth of materials. In some cases, the most expensive component is the input coaxial connector you put on the bottom of the antenna. And the rest of it are plumbing parts, and in some cases they're coat hanger wire pieces that you get either at Home Depot or from your own closet, so to speak. So the one thing that hams are very good at is homebrewing antennas. The raw materials are usually not very expensive, and we can build a zillion of them and keep tweaking it until it works right, and check in with your friends in order to make it work right. We don't build our transmitters and receivers anymore, but we certainly build antennas, sometimes transmission lines, sometimes the support structures for the antenna itself. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure Joe will appreciate that information. The only reason he's suggesting this is because he already had acquired these two antennas from somebody else, and that's why he was thinking of using the T-connector. But I think it's a good start for him, and then he can maybe try to do a J-pole, a dual-band J-pole. That's very good. Okay. Now I have Keith from New Jersey who has a power supply question for you.
Fire away, yeah, John.
Okay, he has a 50-watt transceiver, and he has two 10-amp Radio Shack 12-volt power supplies. He wants to parallel them. He also mentioned something about diodes. I'm assuming he means to use steering diodes out of these power supplies. But could you give him a direction to go and how to do the proper paralleling of those two devices? And should he fuse the outputs, the input of those devices, which I know that that device has a fuse at the back, which is on the primary side, but should he, say, put a 12 or 15 amp fuse in series with each of those steering diodes, I assume he means, to hook that up? So back to you, Dick, and see if you can help him out.
Here there's more than one answer as I see it, John. Many of the power supplies have a simple series regulator. If you look at the schematic diagram and you see that it's got a simple series regulating pass transistor, a power transistor with a heat sink on it, that internally the power supply has got a transformer in many cases. It rectifies the voltage. It probably rectifies the voltage, puts it into a great big filter capacitor at something like 18 volts. The 18 volts has a fair amount of ripple on it. And the series pass transistor and the rest of the electronics is regulating the 18 volts down to 12. The transistor is being turned on and off, more conduction and less conduction, and it's sampling its own output. The electronics is, it's a servo mechanism. It's sampling its output. If the output drops below 12 volts, if that's a set number, I think most of these are set at 13.5. Let me choose 13.5. If the voltage dips below 13.5, the electronic senses that. It gives a command to the pass transistor to turn on a little bit harder, pump some more current in there to bring the 13.4 back up to 13.5. And correspondingly, if it goes up to 13.6, the electronics feeds less command signal to the pass transistor saying, don't conduct so hard. You're overdoing it, if you know what I mean. So if you have a simple power transistor pass type like that, putting them in parallel 99% of the time or 95% of the time, no problem. Works like a charm. Many of these power supplies, and that's a function, again, of studying the schematic or presenting the schematic to somebody like John and I and allowing us to, or telling us the model number, and if we can get a hold of the schematic and study it, many of these power supplies have output current limit.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Many of these power supplies have built-in output current limiting. So in other words, if you put a short circuit on it, it goes down to some reasonable amount of current. Some of them even have so-called fallback current limiting, where it even doesn't dissipate too much power if it goes into a direct short circuit. So many of these power supplies have output protection electronically, in which case the steering diodes, the disadvantage of the steering diodes is you're going to get some voltage drop across the steering diodes, which is going to be a bit annoying. The fuses might not be required. And direct parallel connection is quite possibly allowed. And so studying the schematic, you'd be amazed how simple it could be. Occasionally, when you put two electronic regulated power supplies together, they look at each other and turn into an oscillator if they're not being properly loaded with the right kind of a bleeder resistor. Occasionally, that happens. But even that is not a disaster. So I think I personally have put power supplies in parallel. And if they're a simple power supply, sometimes it's very successful and doesn't have to be very elaborate. So it's a good study in power supply learning, to find out if yours will tolerate direct connection, a pair of them in parallel, particularly where they're identical devices. I think it's a good chance he can do that, Sean. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
M2EO with a comment.
Stand by, John. Go ahead, Rich. I wonder if you've done it, and have you ever run into trouble, and has it worked? You got it, Rich.
That's it. I'm done. The only comment I want to give, he doesn't want current flow from going from one power supply to the other, which means both power supplies have to be adjusted to the identical voltage. That's an easy thing to do. All he has to do is take either there's two ways of doing it. One is when he parallels them up, put an ammeter between the positive side of one power supply and the other side of the ammeter to the other positive terminal on the other power supply, and adjust one power supply, not both, until the current is zero. When there's no potential difference, which means the voltage is the same, there won't be any current flow between the two power supplies. Another way to do it, if he doesn't have an ammeter, take a voltmeter, a regular VTTM, put that between the two power supplies. In other words, connect negative to negative, take one side of the voltmeter to one positive terminal on one supply, the negative terminal to the other power supply, and adjust the one power supply until the meter reads exactly 0 volts. When there's no potential difference, there can't be current flow between the two supplies. Over to you, Peggy.
What you just suggested, Rich, is absolutely right, and it's a good conservative approach. But in some cases, you don't have to do that. If the power supply has a simple pass transistor on the positive side of both supplies, and it's two identical supplies, and let's assume that one supply is set at 13.5 and the other one is set at 13.3, and you put them directly in parallel, the output will be 13.5. The power supply that's set at 13.3 knows that the output voltage is higher than its set number. Therefore, it's commanding its pass transistor to be off. The current that flows from the 13.5 supply into the 13.3 supply is only the bleeder resistor current, if there happens to be a bleeder resistor on both supplies to ground. It's a very small amount of current. So if it is a simple pass transistor type power supply, the exact setting is the Cadillac approach, but it might not be required. The one at the lower number, the one disadvantage of what I just said is that for the majority of running of the equipment where you're not drawing enough current to put the first supply into limiting, where the second supply starts supplying current to the real load, your real transmitters, is that now all the work is being done by one supply, and he's creating all the heat. So that's a major disadvantage in what I'm talking about here. What Rich is saying is obviously the right way to go. Now they're always sharing the current. They're always getting equally as warm, and it's the right way to do it. Let me pass it back to you, Rich, if you've got any further comments on that. If they're close, it may not be as bad as you think. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, maybe I'm a purist, but that's the way I've done it in the past. So, just wanted to make that comment, N2EO.
Hey, KC2, George, you have a comment?
Yeah, before we go to Glenn, Rich, how often have you put power supplies in series? And by your technique, which is the good conservative technique, has it always worked? Have you ever run into any glitches when you put equal power supplies together? And I'll bet you in some cases you even put different brand names and different model numbers together. Tell us how often you've done it, and I'll bet you almost all the times it worked. Over to you, Rich.
Run it in the pinch, Dick, with 20 amp Astrons, and I've mixed power supplies. That's why I felt mixing brands, mixing models within the same brand. I just didn't want to, I don't know, it just seems something wrong about having current flow flowing in a loop between the two supplies. Something else I've done, Dick, is which is similar, is paralleling transformers. And there you have to get the phase right. which is the same sort of thing. When you do, when you hook two transformer primaries in parallel, you want them in phase. So you put a voltmeter, you connect, you take one wire from one transformer, hook it to the wire, one of the wires of the other, and then the other two wires put a voltmeter. If you see zero, they're in phase. If you see voltage, they're bucking and just reverse one. So that's another trick, sort of along the same line.
Yeah, back in the old days when we needed a whole lot of current at 6.3 volts in order to feed a whole lot of filaments of transmitters and receivers and whatever, if I had two transformers side by side, and each one had a 6.3 volt winding that's good for, let's say, 10 amps, and I've got a total of 15 amps of load, it's very tempting to parallel the two primaries of the two transformers and parallel the two 6.3 volt secondary windings. And there you got to be a little bit careful. Without a doubt, you first check that if they're out of phase between the two, you'll measure 12 volts instead of 6.3. I mean, if you phase them correctly, you'll measure with one wire out of each connected together and the remaining two wires, you put a voltmeter between the two. If you phase them correctly, you'll measure 0 volts almost. And if you phase them wrong, you'll measure 12.6 volts if you got them out of phase. But when you get them to read nearly 0 volts, if one transformer happened to have multiple taps on the primary, you know, a 105, a 110, and a 115, and a 120 volt tap on the primary, you'd want to make sure that those primaries are tapped the right way so that the two windings at 6.3 appear to be almost identical. If one of them was 6.3 and one of them was 6.5, now you've got a continuous 2/10 of a volt difference between the two, and the nastiness about a transformer, let me drop, real voltage generator, it's a bipolar low impedance voltage generator. In the case of those series pass transistor type DC power supplies, you can get away with some murder there where the voltages are wrong. In other words, one is set at 13.5 and one set at 13.3 volts DC. And you put them in parallel, it's going to fly. But in the case of windings of a transformer where it is a bipolar, in other words, at the instant the transformer wants to put out positive 6.5 and the other one wants to put out positive 6.3, at that instant, a significant amount of current is flowing from one to the other. And then on the other half cycle, minus 6.5 and minus 6.3, a lot of current, again, will be flowing from one to the other. So in the case of a transformer where the real impedance of the winding when it's in operation is a rather small Thevenin impedance signal generator, so to speak, you now can get substantial amount of current flowing between the two with no load at all. So there you got to be a little bit careful. And I think you see the point on that one. Glenn, I wonder how many power supplies you put in parallel, particularly when you're feeding all these beautiful light-emitting diode luminaries that you generate. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and good evening to everybody on the net. Just a small point about switching, any kind of power supplies in parallel, for that matter, is that the fuses are really not required at all. The diodes are definitely a mistake. You don't want to use diodes, just a general sharing arrangement between two power supplies. They're really for a different application, but that's not this one. What I would suggest is that don't bother adjusting the voltages on the output of the power supplies, because if you were to take two power supplies rated for 10 amperes and you were to run them at 15 amps and then adjust the voltages so that they're equal, so that the current is equal from both power supplies, you'll notice as you change the load impedance around, they won't share at other current levels, mainly because what makes two power supplies share is the impedance on the output of the power supply to the load. Let me let this drop for a minute. So, being that the output voltage dropping that's adding up between the outputs of the power supplies to the load itself is what's key to having the current share between the two power supplies, what's more important is that the lead length connections, so in other words, if you have power supply number one, which is 12 volts at 10 amps, and power supply number two, would be to use equal length and equal wire gauge cables so that if you have a 3-foot length of cables coming off of one power supply, you have an equal length and gauge of wires coming from the second power supply. Then tie them together at one point, like a terminal block, and then connect your load or your transceiver at that point. And then I think you'll find that any kind of dissimilar voltages and everything will basically drop across the load cable and really won't be all that significant, and the operation should be pretty good. Back to you, Dick. K2RZW, KC2QIQ.
This is John. Good information there. I'm going to go one step beyond. Let me warn you now, John, that what I'm about to say is a little bit beyond, I know, what your writer was asking for. But there are other people listening on this net that might get some good information out of this. If I had an electronic regulated power supply, and I set it at 13.5 volts of output, and I now graph, I'm now making an XY graph where the vertical axis is voltage that I sense, the horizontal axis is current. Is that the way I should do it? Yes, that's the way I should do it. Horizontal axis is current, vertical axis is voltage. If the power supply was ideal, and I set it up on that vertical line, and now as I start putting various loads on the power supply so that it draws 1 amp, 3 amps, 5 amps, and so on, 10 amps, and I start putting dots on the curve, if the power supply was ideal, of output will make a pure horizontal line. That's an ideal power supply with zero lead length going into the real load. Let me drop. Now let's get to the real world. The real world of a power supply, nothing is ideal. At the power supply itself, at its sensing point internally, if it's internal sensed, when I go up to 10 amperes of output, the 13.5 volts maybe is going to drop down to 13.3 volts. That's a real power supply. So there's a slight negative slope to the output curve of voltage versus current. And that's power supply number one. And as I change the wiring between that power supply and the real load, assuming I'm not using remote sensing now, I've got ordinary wiring, as I add a real length of wire, maybe the power supply is going to sit on the floor and my rig is going to sit on the table and they're 5 feet apart. And that 5 feet of wiring has some voltage drop. So now at the rig, I draw the graph again. I draw the voltage versus current graph, and now there's a more negative slope. Maybe it's now going to drop down to 13.1 volts at full current output because of the voltage drop of the wiring. That's power supply number one. At power supply number two, with its wiring, I do a similar curve. And if those two curves had the identical slope, yes, they would track each other. In the real world, each power supply has got a slightly different curve. If I've got slightly different wiring and different wiring resistance because I didn't tighten one on the lugs quite the right way, let me drop. I'm now going to be drawing real operating graphs of output voltage versus current, and the two graphs will not completely track. Maybe those two slopes are a little bit different. Because the slopes are different, I could now set 0 volts of difference between the two power supply at no current, no load at all, and under real load, because the slopes are different, way out there at 10 amperes out of each power supply, now there's a real potential difference between the two, and they're not sharing the load. So if you want to go the next step, you either make a set of measurements, and maybe you draw those curves, and now you find out, hey, this is the place, this is the current where I use it most of the time. That's the place where I want the two curves to cross over each other so that now the two power supplies share the current. So drawing the real load line of your power supply with its wiring is an interesting way to go. And the next step beyond that is to use power supplies that have remote sensing. That doesn't, in other words, in another set of wires that go all the way out to the real load, the real transmitter, find out what the voltage is there, and the power supply way back at the input end of that wiring adjusts itself accordingly. In the shack, remote sensing is almost not required. Let me drop. However, if I've got a 12-volt high-power solid-state amplifier that I'm putting on top of the tower right at the antenna, and my tower is 100 feet tall, so I've now got 110 foot of wiring between the real power supply in the shack and the real load on top of the tower. In that particular case, I'd be getting ridiculous amounts of voltage drop if I wasn't using a, you know, double aught gauge wire going up the tower, and I couldn't afford that amount of copper. The smart guy in that case will use a power supply that's got some extra voltage capability, He'll put another skinny piece of wire up there that does remote sensing. In other words, his second set of wires right at the transmitter at the top of the tower is finding out exactly what voltage the transmitter is receiving, because that wiring doing the sensing has no current flow through it. There's no voltage drop, and that information is being coupled back to the power supply. The electronic regulation of the power supply is adjusting itself accordingly, and maybe the power supply is putting out 16 volts so that after the wiring drop of 120 feet of wiring, the transmitter sees 13.5, what it wants to see at the top of the tower. So matching power supplies, whether there's one or more of them, the real load lines, remote sensing or local sensing, as you can see, you can have a lot of fun with this stuff, and the bottom line of all this is... engineer comes out of school and he finds out he's going to work on power supplies. He says, oh, that's the ugly part of it. I wanted to work on these sophisticated transmitters and phase lock loops and fancy receiver techniques with synchronous demodulators and product detectors. I wanted to work on the real stuff. I didn't want to work on power supplies. You'd be amazed how many engineers will say that. The bottom line is that the most common point of failure of the real world is power supply. You can have a gold-plated transmitter and a silver-plated receiver, and if the power supply is not in the air, you're not on the air. You're dead in the water, if you know what I mean. So making a real good, self-protecting, well-regulated, non-oscillating, stable power supply that can work with all the glitches of the input voltages and over-voltages, under-voltages, and everything else, and really be reliable, that there's a lot of art and science there. One of the things I'm kind of proud of is some very well-designed, I think, power supplies that were used on the B-1 bomber receiver system. And I had something to do with those power supplies, and I had worked on a previous program where I got onto the program at the tail end, and they were getting all kinds of oscillation problems with power supplies and failures and so on. You had to buy particular brands of pass transistors or the thing became unstable. And I cut my teeth on that, and I decided that on the next program, we're going to do a better job. And we had almost no failures by comparison. So good power supplies, there's a lot of art and science that goes into it. It's not as bad as you think. Over to you, John. I know we got way off the subject, but I think there's some valuable information here because your writer got us into a good subject, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2EO with a footnote, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, talking about remote sensing, you know, Heath Kidd had a radio out of South State Radio back around 1980 called the SD-104. It was a broadband South State transceiver, and the matching power supply was PS, I think it was 1144. They did just that. They had a wire, I remember it was a white wire, within the umbilical cable that came off the regulator, and they sensed the voltage right at the back of the radio on the 8-pin plug. So the voltage was very steady because they were sensing it right where it went into the radio.
There are some very sophisticated remote sensing circuits. There's been a couple of integrated circuits designed that go one step beyond. I'm trying to remember which article it was in Electronic Design News 3 or 4 months ago, where a particular company has designed a particular integrated circuit where it does remote sensing without even using a remote sensing wire. The power supply puts a very small AC signal at a high frequency into the input of the wiring. It senses how much impedance that wiring has, even though there isn't a remote sensing wire, and it adjusts its voltage output accordingly. There's a bypass capacitor at the load, so it doesn't see the small high-frequency signal that the electronic regulator is putting on the wire. So there are ways of doing remote sensing without a remote sensing wire. There's an integrated circuit designed to do that, and from what I can tell, it does a beautiful job. So you think that power supplies were designed way back in 1920 and nothing has happened since? Uh-huh. There's a lot more to the story than you know about. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Great, Dick. I think we gave Keith enough information to get started. The only other thing I would add to that is I would suggest to him to get maybe some 12-volt automobile bulbs of different wattages, maybe something like 50 watts, and load the power supplies and read the voltages to see if the regulators are basically within, say, 5% of each other. But everything you said is true, and I think he would have no problem, even if he didn't do anything, just tie them together. I mean, I've done it before, and it does seem to work. As long as, very important what Glenn had said about keeping the wires the same, I think you should tie the power supplies at their output points to begin with and bring your leads down. But, yeah, he's got great information there, and I don't think he'll have any problem with that. And by the way, Dick, these are not coming from the Limark web. I haven't been set up with that yet. These are just questions. There were four questions sent to me this week on my email. So these two were the ones that made sense. So thank you very much. I'm sure they'll appreciate it. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
John, are you encouraging people to send some of these questions directly to you? That's your choice. And if so, do you want to tell them where they would go or how they would find your particular website, your email address, I should say, if you want to encourage it? That's your choice. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, Dick, they could do that. I will give you the email. I'm not looking for the established hands with the complicated questions. They can come on the net and do that. But these young people that don't have radios or have radios and just got their license and not on the air yet, it's important to get these people up and running. I can be reached at jv5oscar@aol.com.
So that's Juliet Delta 5, Oscar@AOL.com. Is that a QSL?
Juliet Bravo 5, Oscar@AOL.com.
Good thing we checked. Juliet Bravo 5, Oscar. Now, I bet you there are a lot of people that look at that 500 and they think it's 500 instead of 5, Oscar. Has that mistake been made before, John? Go ahead.
Many times, Dick. Many times. Even when I tell them Oscar. It's 00. Difficult. By the way, Dick, I mailed you a copy of Scientific American, the daily update. I don't know if you received that. I sent it to your commercial account. I didn't have your local.
How long ago did you send that, John?
3 days ago, I think.
Huh. I'm getting a little worried. Glenn sent me today to something to my RIW products number, and it didn't come through. Then he sent it to another address, and it did come through. So, Glenn, I got your second mailing. I never got your first mailing. So there's some kind of a hang-up with my first mailing all of a sudden. And so you sent me something that I didn't get also. Got to worry about that. One further thing on power supply. Let me drop. Most of the transmitters that we buy these days that are made for desktop operation or automobile operation, those 12-volt input leads are very well bypassed, no problem. But when you take something like a afterburner amplifier, a Mirage Baker 1016, for instance, and many other things that look like that, these afterburner amplifiers, you study that schematic and you realize the 12-volt input lead has very, very poor radio bypassing by comparison to a well-designed rig. In fact, in the case of a Mirage Baker 1016 2-meter amplifier, which is capable of putting out 160 watts, when it's cranking out 160 watts out of its output UHF connector, I'll bet you 2 watts of RF is coming out of the 12-volt lead. You trace that 12-volt lead the way it goes into that package. It just goes through a rubber grommet, so to speak, and somewhere in there, a few inches down range, there's a little bit of a dis-ceramic bypass capacitor on the PC board. Turns out that all that 12-volt wiring in that box is an antenna picking up that very strong local signal and sending it back out the 12-volt wiring. The bottom line of all this is that signal, for instance, coming back on the 12-volt wiring, goes into the regulated power supply and goes into its integrated circuit chip, gets rectified. It manages to change the reference voltage or the sensing voltage and the power supply can go crazy. In some cases, the power supply will put out higher than normal voltage. In some cases, it'll put out lower than normal voltage simply because it's being subjected to RF energy it was not designed to see. Let me drop. So the right answer in this particular case is to use a non-radio sensitive voltmeter. A real good digital voltmeter, or maybe an old-fashioned volt-ohm-milliammeter, right at the power supply. Measure the voltage coming out of the power supply as you turn on that transmitter and that afterburner. And if you see the power supply doing anything funny, or even if you want to ahead of time be on the safe side, put some disc ceramic capacitors from the output lead to the local ground at the power supply. You want to create RF bypassing at the power supply, so that afterburner amplifier cannot drive it crazy, if you know what I mean. You want to bypass the RF energy before it gets back to the power supply. RF energy getting into a power supply will quite often do some very funny things. Wonder if anyone else has run into that problem. I know I have. If so, give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. I heard both of Rich and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
I got one. I was playing around with the high power on 432. I needed a 40-watt intermediate amplifier to drive a pair of 4CX250Ks. And I used the KLM, I think it was a 10-in, 35-watt out on 70 centimeters. And when I put it near a regulated supply, the power supply went nuts. Started dropping voltage. It wasn't a matter of bypassing in my case. The KLM 10 in 35 out was leaking like a sieve. If I moved it a few feet away from the supply, just physically separated them, because I had the supply sitting, the amp sitting on top of the supply. If I moved it away, the problem went away.
Good to know, Rich. The people who have added one of those solid-state amplifiers to a well-operating repeater almost always got in trouble. You need real good isolation between all of the receiver wiring and its power supplies and all of the transmitter wiring and its power supplies when you're running a single-site repeater where you're transmitting and receiving at the same site, usually with the same antenna. Those brick amplifiers almost always are a no-no in that location. They leak, Rich was telling us, they leak an awful lot of signal. I wonder if you run into things like this, Glenn. KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And one of the best solutions I've found for RF energy coming out of coming from a transceiver or an amplifier back into a power supply is to basically take a ferrite inductor and take the lead in common mode. So in other words, I take two wires together, the plus and the minus, and wind about 3 to 4 turns through a piece of ferrite core. And basically what that's doing is it's not filtering anything differentially, but any kind of RF that's going to try to run down those cables back into the power supply is basically all choked off. And to stop things at, VHF and UHF, once they hit that ferrite core, they stop right in their tracks. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Good suggestion, Glenn. And the guy who wants belt and suspenders will do both. They'll wind the wiring through that ferrite choke that you just mentioned. That gives them a series inductor as far as the RF is concerned, without creating any additional DC voltage drop. And bypass capacitors, good brand of disc ceramic capacitors at the power supply, as close as you can get to the cabinet. Again, the choke is going to knock down the RF energy some number of decibels. The bypass capacitors are going to knock down the RF energy some number of decibels. And both of those add together and will really do a good job of protecting your power supply. But now let me show you another problem that guys have run into. In the case of the 1 kilohertz approximately whine that you get from an automobile three-phase alternator, there are many guys who have got a transmitter in the car, and then when the battery is being charged by the alternator, you can tell exactly how fast the guy is driving because you hear the whine of the alternator going higher and lower in frequency as he presses on the accelerator pedal. because the alternator itself is supposed to have six diodes in a three-phase rectifying circuit. Let me drop. And if one of those diodes is a little bit flaky, so that now you're not getting three phases of rectification, but you're 2.5 phases, so to speak, or maybe one of the diodes is dead entirely, or if you've got a battery that's at the end of life, in other words, your car battery has been subjected to the headlights being left on all day long. You went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, left the headlights on, came out at 4:30 in the afternoon, and the headlights are real dim, and the battery has really been drained. Well, you do that to a battery, and in many cases, if you discharge it far enough, it's permanently damaged. And from then on, the battery will have a much higher internal impedance, and therefore the normal filtering action you get from the alternator wind is not happening so well. So the right solution in that case is to replace the battery. But there are guys who will say, okay, I'll put a 1 Henry series choke between the 12-volt wiring of the car and my transmitter, and that way we'll filter out the 1 KC wind that's coming from the alternator. Let me drop. A properly chosen choke of the right number of Henrys with the right kind of a current rating in series with the 12-volt wiring of your transmitter and its afterburner amplifier will filter out the 1 KC wind. Does a pretty cool job. But now you've created another huge problem. Let's assume that you did choose a 1 Henry choke, and 1 Henry maybe is the right number. Let's assume that your afterburner amplifier plus transmitter is drawing a total of 20 amperes. Now let's study how much stored magnetic energy is in that 1 Henry choke. Stored energy in joules is 1/2 Li squared. L is 1 Henry. I is 20 amperes. I squared is 400. 400 times 1 divided by 2, you got 200 joules of stored energy in the magnetic field of that series inductor in the example I just gave you. So when the transmitter is cranking and drawing 20 amperes, everything's hunky-dory. At the instant you turn off the transmitter, the 20 ampere load on the far side of that choke goes to essentially zero load. You got 200 joules of stored energy, and it's in an inductor, and it says, I'm going to give it back to you as an inductive kickback. And when it does that, the voltage coming out of that inductor going into your rig can easily jump to 30 volts, maybe even beyond. And your rig is rated in such a way that it's supposed to see 13.5, and it can tolerate a glitch of 18, but beyond that, it might be damaged. So you simply put that series inductor there, and you think you're doing a good job. And you think that as long as it doesn't do anything bad, at the instant you turn on the transmitter, you're home free. The problem is when you turn the transmitter off, and the current goes to some much lower value. So unless you've got in there a real Stucci Zener diode at, say,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Unless you've got a real Stucci Zener diode at, say, 16 volts or so rating on the output side of that inductor right across the transmitter itself to protect you from that inductive kickback, that inductor wants to give you a... If he really went to 0 volts, the inductor would give you a nearly infinite voltage. He would draw a spark. You'd be amazed how far the spark would be across that inductor if his load really went to zero. The only reason why some guys even survive this is that when the rig goes back to the receive mode, it still draws a little bit of current. But that great big change in the current is going to give you an inductive kickback, and a smart guy can calculate exactly what voltage he's going to get out, and maybe his rig is going to be damaged by it. You've got to be careful with those series inductors. That's way beyond the kind of inductor that Glenn was telling us about, but you'd be amazed how many funny glitches you can get out of power supply systems. Who would ever think that a series inductor would be that dangerous? And if you have any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized? Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I think you bring up a very, very good point that's not... I don't think I've ever seen it written any place, but it's really something that should be... I think even probably added as part of the technical test. And that's, you see the transceiver connection where they show basically how to wire a transceiver back to a battery. And when I speak of an inductor, I'll always make the distinction, I'll say common mode. That means you're taking both wires together and running them through a core. On a transceiver, you never, in virtually any kind of transceiver where you're getting a very, very large change in current, you know, typically between, let's say, half an amp to an amp, all the way up to 10 amps, and then back down again. Whenever there's an inductor in series with that, that's a disaster. And even the Zener diode would never protect you in that.